But people take the central nervous system, like Tom Wolfe, as the physical part of your inner landscape, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's as far as they take it.
Jordan Peterson does the same thing.
Jordan Peterson. Oh, have you read him?
Not much, but I've read enough to know that one of his hang-ups is trying to get everything to hook up to the
soul.
Central nervous system, and to the cortex and all this stuff.
Oh, he uses brain materialism, you mean? Brain anatomy?
Well, yeah. I wouldn't say he uses as much as he's in search of some brain hookup.
Interesting. I'm not familiar enough with him to know that. Is there? Do you want to say a bit more, or is that enough about that hang up?
Well, I think that Peterson's a pretty interesting guy in some senses, but he's a Gutenbergian figure.
Yeah.
So that if he were to encounter McLuhan, then he would find many things that he should think about and that would deepen his thought. And the amazing thing about Peterson not doing anything with McLuhan is that there are so many parallels between the two guys. I mean, they're both born in Alberta. They both taught briefly in the United States before they came back to the University of Toronto. They both taught at University of Toronto for decades. They both were viciously attacked by colleagues at Toronto. People were trying to throw both of them out.
Yeah. And they both became figures at a tumultuous time.
Correct, and became world famous.
Yeah.
Right? So, and you could say they rode surfed the networks that were available at the time.
Yeah, so, now let me tell you, I have thought of that much. Let me tell you how I laid it out a couple of years ago. The Electric Global Theater was making people more tribal. We're talking, I call it Madison Avenue McLuhan, cliche McLuhan, the popular image. So McLuhan, he becomes a figure from the Gutenberg Galaxy who seems to be hip to the post-Gutenberg Galaxy, and his image and the way he presents himself seems to be a guy who's not interested in books anymore, is defected from books, and is celebrating the global theater tribalism. Now, we know that that's nowhere near McLuhan, but that was the image of him. And so he was a necessary guide for the corporate establishment to help these old fuddy-duddies from World War II and before to handle what was happening to their children and to society. He was a priest, a go-between, a mediator between the kids and the parents.
Yeah, okay. Could have been. Never was, but could have been.
A little bit at his best peak in 67, but that didn't last long because it was more complex what he was talking about. Okay, so McLuhan's a literate guy who appears to be pro-tribal. So then along comes, 50 years later, McLuhan had predicted in 1970 in Cultures Are Business that we were going to flip into visual values again. As we move more into the tactile and the hyperkinetic, people have more and more nostalgia for visual values, and I would say that's McLuhan predicting neoconservatism that came in with Reagan and the subsequent few decades. Okay, now the social media is having unforeseen effects, and it seemed to make people yearn for the Gutenberg or visual values that McLuhan predicted, but it was more complex. So I said you had the exact opposite of McLuhan. You had a tribal guy, Peterson. McLuhan's literate, and he's putting on the tribal, Peterson is tribal, putting on the literate.
Correct.
Understanding the ground of literacy, but putting on the literate and meets a felt need for the visual values that supposedly men are yearning for, and the right hemisphere women have taken over and actually have put on the visual values and become aggressive and the whole complex stuff between the sexes. He's the exact opposite of McLuhan going in the opposite direction. But the world has flipped away from McLuhan, so that if McLuhan showed up as himself now and Peterson, Peterson would win because he was resonating with the present more than old McLuhan would be if he was today. Do you know what I mean? It's a different situation.
But, you mean resonating with the present as it conceives itself, not as it is.
Not the facts. Yeah, just within the world of effect.
Yeah.
So,
and you know, you use the phrase, and then 50 years later, along comes Peterson. And what's interesting about that is McLuhan was born in 1911, and Peterson was born in 1962. So when you say 50 years later, along comes Peterson, you could be talking about their births.
Right. Interesting. And, you know, 62 is a key year in McLuhan's world.
Absolutely.
Okay, so what I just said, which I was thinking and talked about in interviews or in my radio show 2 or 3 years ago about Peterson, was based just on superficial seeing him on YouTube and interaction with people. I hadn't read any of his books. What struck me is he had the same situation as McLuhan. People didn't know that McLuhan was this heavy book guy and a revolution in literary theory and all that. They just thought he was a guy who thought TV was cool. What I noticed in Peterson's lectures, he was a psychologist. He had a great knowledge of Gutenberg mythic encyclopedism, you know, just all the traditional archetypes and humanist classical humanism, which people didn't know about him. He was just a guy who would dare to argue with the students out in the schoolyard about their ridiculous confusion, quadriphenia, about what their bodies were. You know what I mean? Remember that YouTube? He's out arguing with the kids on the University of Toronto campus. With the fanatics, the social justice warriors. That's how he became known. That went viral, that YouTube.
Yeah.
And then you start to listen to some of his lectures, and you find out, you know, the guy was heavily Gutenberg. He had a good education and background in Jung and Freud and classical mythology and everything. So, again, he's exactly like McLuhan. People didn't know who they were dealing with or what was coming out of the university. And then Peterson gets sick like McLuhan.
Exactly. And when, right? Peterson gets sick in 1919, and he's...
Not 2019.
I'm sorry, 2019, yeah. And so I believe,
McLuhan has a surgery in 67.
That's right, and so... McLuhan at that time is 56, 57 years of age, right?
They're the same age.
Yeah. So that's and so the result of Peterson's illness is described by his daughter as aphasia,
which is like aphasia.
The inability. Yeah, but it's the inability to sit still to. Come across to everybody as having the heebie-jeebies.
Would you say it's the inability to sit still?
Yeah, and to come across as having the heebie-jeebies. That's what happened in McLuhan.
In what way? How was that McLuhan?
Yeah, when Carpenter Judith Fitzgerald as two, describe what happened to McLuhan during the 60s when he was having his blackouts, his mini strokes and stuff. And then he had the severe one in 1960 when he was given the last race. They say that McLuhan became an old man overnight, that he couldn't keep still, that people didn't recognize sort of the cool cucumber guy of the 50s anymore. And that's what happened to Peterson in 2019.
Right. So, okay. So when I became aware of Peterson and his lectures, and also it's a retrieval of the oral dialogue or long listenings. And people were almost nostalgic for the classroom and listening to a Northrop Frye or something go on and on and on. They were getting that on YouTube, you know, sit and listening to oral discourse.
Yeah.
So that's a little pre-tactile. It's a nostalgia.
Yeah, so it was a mixed message is always going on.
Yeah.
Because Peterson is definitely a Gutenbergian point of view, heroic, as he describes it, figure. But at the same time, he's always emphasizing dialogue, connection,
and emotion.
Tradition.
He's agonizing.
Yeah. So it's definitely a mixed message thing. And there again, that's part of his success.
Yeah, there's McLuhan, very cool and detached, puts fakes involvement and with it.
Correct.
And Peterson is a very emotional tribal guy, faking literate detachment.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, so when I started to listen to him a bit, I said, oh, this guy doesn't know McLuhan. And so I was waiting for an opportunity to tell him about, you know, bump into him, email him or something. But what happened is somebody did it. He was being interviewed when he's well famous and in London and being interviewed all over the world just before he's ill. And he said in there somewhere, someone had brought up McLuhan. He said, yes, this has been drawn to my, you know, my attention, been drawn to this. And I've looked at McLuhan and I definitely, there's something there. I've got to take the time to look at more deeply. He admitted.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah. He admitted that it was something he needed to study a bit more. He recognized it was relevant, probably because he was getting this media massage in his fame. And he was probably looking at his user as content and a bit puzzled by the chaos around his image, the misinterpretation and the noise and the setups and the whole media battle of what McLuhan said, dancing on the other guy's toes. Man, did his toes get danced on. I think that he hadn't seen that coming, having been in the cloister classroom. And whatever people said McLuhan was telling him, it resonated with that disservice that he had encountered, which probably made him sick. You know what I mean? So,
yes,
the question
those are all good points.
What'd you say?
Those are all good points.
Thank you. And so somebody needs to call him up and say, did you do your McLuhan yet? I mean, he got ill. He may not have been able to do it. He's supposedly recovered now, and he's got his own talk show or whatever. I never watch it, but I should watch and see if there's a way to just, you know, input, you know, send an email and say, did you do your McLuhan homework? That needs to be asked of him.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
The what he says he wants to do is help to introduce a kind of revolutionary conceptuality that would help the world to a new understanding of itself. I think that's very important.
He sounds like you. He wants to do you.
Maybe.
Yeah,
if you marry that to a Gutenbergian heroism and perspectivism, then it doesn't work.
Right.
And so you're absolutely right that what he needs to do is engage, I would say, not only McLuhan, but Harold Innes.
That's right, and us.
And, yeah, but it's I at least don't have much connection to Toronto. You do.
Yeah.
But for Peterson to be talking all the time about the need to engage tradition, and that's a problem with the younger generation that they haven't done that. He hasn't engaged with the University of Toronto tradition.
That's right. And so,
and he needs to do that.
Yeah, and it would be very responsible if Bob Logan, De Kirchhoff, or any of those Toronto school guys that are around there, if they haven't told them this, they should notice this and tell them. You know
yeah.
what I mean? They should be pointing out the McLuhan angle, or encouraging him to look into it and ask him to talk about it, what homework he's doing. So, okay, so so we both noticed the incredible mirror image reality. It's something unique about, you remember Don Thiel said the University of Toronto campus was unique. It created a guy like McLuhan in the 50s because there were five colleges, five religions, and a very unique environment. I never thought the University of Toronto remained cool once McLuhan was gone, but did it remain cool? Not cool McLuhan was, it was just relevant. Why does it produce the next big guy? You know what I mean? That's what's interesting about the University of Toronto campus doing that.
Correct. Yeah, no, I think that's a side of Toronto that most people don't know much about, but having the Medieval Institute there, which is very heavy-duty scholarship, having a huge philosophy department, one of the best in the world, if not the best. These are, I don't know what you would call it, dynamic centers in Toronto that is generating intense insights far beyond themselves.
Right. So here's what you say gives me this pattern. Canada is a 19th century country. When McLuhan's day, where he used to say that Canada had the advantage of being irrelevant to the 20th century, but right beside the big elephant, so we would watch America, and we'd have a philosophical detachment about it, and we'd contemplate the global theater. Okay, let's assume there's still a bit of that in Toronto. It's still old-fashioned, and so there's a bit of human scale at the University of Toronto that you wouldn't get in the big universities, the mega universities in the States, even though University of Toronto is a big population. But there's still the small-town Canadian aspect, and that allows a chemical body, human-scale guy to show up and interact with the students, which you probably wouldn't see in any campus in the United States. You just see riots or something, you know. It's more mass tribalism. But it's the human scale of Canada and the University of Toronto, which makes it the ideal academic environment for a figure like McLuhan or Peterson to be visible.
Maybe.
Yep, I'm going with that for now until you come up with something better. So all this
One thing to notice about them is that Peterson's book,
the
his
12
only
rules?
Book until
the 12 rules?
No, those are 12 rules. That's new stuff. He's written a couple of books on that. But his original claim to fame is Maps of Meaning.
Oh, yeah.
And first off, that gets back to the Cambridge English School.
Yeah.
And the whole idea that there is that you have to figure out the types of ambiguity in order to understand anything, right? So Peterson produces this book, but it's completely divorced from the considerations that are made in other disciplines, like English. Right? So he kind of takes up what McLuhan was doing his whole life, but completely ignoring McLuhan.
Right, and so the Cambridge background.
And the Cambridge background, and I mean, there's just, I could go on and on and on about what he ignores. But the amazing thing is that you have this idea of maps of meaning. And so McLuhan would say, well, the medium is the message. Therefore, you have to first define maps in order to have maps of meaning.
Yeah.
Right? If you haven't defined the map, then it's useless. And so Peterson by not getting into this relevant background, did not understand sort of the crucial point that he himself was making.
Yes, he did.
Right? And so he made his whole career by kind of interjecting into very, very academic discussions in psychology about experiments with rats and experiments by taking mammals and cutting their spinal column in various places and really gruesome sort of stuff. Interjecting in that the whole world of myth, the whole world of Dostoevsky and Jung and Tolstoy and all that stuff. Not that Peterson understands these people with great acuity, but just that these topics, these themes, these subjects were completely unknown in his field. And so that he became, let's say by 20 years ago or something, he was the guru of mythology and of existentialism in the field of psychology.
Yeah. And that's the problem. He stayed too much in modern psychology. He doesn't know the classical ground of, say, Greek literacy of our psyche, where the psyche came
Correct.
From.
Yeah, this is absolutely true. And that's because although he talks about Plato and he talks about, you know, Leibniz and Hegel and all this sort of stuff, what he hasn't done is pursued any of these people deeply enough to get into the real problems that they instigate. And because he hasn't done that, he's able to remain at the level of the Gutenbergian hero, which is just unfortunate.
And it's not going to work, and you'll get sick again.
Maybe. It'll work to make him fabulously wealthy. He'll become like Midas.
Right. Now, remember, his goal a couple of years ago was to create a new university. Remember that?
Correct. Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And in a way, McClellan wanted to do that, and Thiel wanted to. So he's even putting on the McClellan agenda or goal or somehow revitalize education. But it's pretty hard to do that today in the media mix we're in. That's why, you know, when you were proposing to do that, you know, several months ago, I had to put you through a rigorous inquiry and investigation and what is the other one? Inquisition about what the hell you thought you were going to do.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty hard to do. I mean, he has, what is he now? He's a guy who has a YouTube talk show, right?
Well, I mean, no, it's far more than that. I mean, he's on YouTube, he's writing books, he's going around the world dialoguing with people. he's got, you know, tens of millions of followers 24 hours a day. So he has the attention, the wealth, and some of the motivations to actually accomplish some of the things that need to be accomplished.
Yeah, he is doing what you would have avoided doing, but with the same goal, but not to end up like him. What he's doing, so he's kind of making a mistake. So,
well, maybe we'll see.
Right, but
you know, it's,
he can't be successful without the McLuhanism.
That's right, but McLuhan himself, after 1960, he not only became recurrently ill, he also became fabulously famous. And it's not clear that his fame did him any good.
He even said, let's see, I found that in my archives. He admitted he had failed. I have a transcript of, in the letters this guy sent me, of him at the University of Toronto in February 69, so he's been a big deal, 66, 67, 68, and he's meeting with the president and Bissell and those guys, and they're trying to figure out what can we do with the student, the Bob Rays and the student radicals, and they want to do something about it and recognize it seriously, but they're at their wit's end about what to do. And McLuhan says in there, they bring up about, well, what we could do, which was sort of, I mean, we need a Jordan Peterson kind of thing, and in their terms back then. And McLuhan says, well, I already did it. And they all start laughing. That's right. And he said, it didn't work. He's saying it. It's like his inside private point of view to his buddies at the University of Toronto board level. So that's a really interesting confession that he's saying in 69. And then throughout 69 into 70, the media jumped on him, and he had to retreat. I mean, I talked to his brother Morris in about 70, 71, and he says, we're not going out there speaking anymore. We're sticking here in Toronto. We're just going to do it work locally. Now, he doesn't really start to go out there and be in the media again until 74 when Newsweek interviews him, and I remember saying, oh, McLuhan's back. He says that public transportation won't work because Americans go out to be alone. So that was his new insight, you know, that he was flogging in 73, 74. So he used it in his first return interview in Newsweek because he wasn't right. He wasn't in the popular media in 71, 72, 73. Mm-hmm. Maybe a couple of – what?
Well, there's two things I would say to that. I don't want to interrupt you, though, if you were
– Yeah, let me just finish that. So, okay. But he did a conscious media ecological posture of retreating from the media fame. And that's what he and Moore said they were doing in 71, 72, and he did that as much as he could. I think he got – that's also the time he got into fighting the Spadina Expressway. That was his local – media ecology, so to speak. So
yeah, yeah.
Let me just
say that in 1970, he had already been very sick, of course, from his brain tumor.
Right.
1970 had a bad heart attack, and they discovered that his arteries were all screwed up in his neck.
Yes.
So he was a very sick man for a couple of years there at the start of the 70s.
Yeah, 70 and 72. He had a crisis in 76. He had three problems. You know, he had to be hospitalized.
Correct. Well, just on and on and on, sure.
Yeah.
But he, at least in the early 70s, he was in no physical shape to really engage with the media.
Yeah, and so that may be a reason why he did retreat. That's another private reason. He didn't have the energy to do it.
Correct. But when you say that he then reappeared in around 74 and his new message was Americans go out to be alone, this is actually a new formulation of a thought that he had always had. Because what McLuhan means by going out to be alone isn't, physically walking into a restaurant with your date and you're alone or something. What he means is the persona that's put on by people to go out into the world is not subject to correction by others. It's
by your, what? By your, others, did
by
you say?
By others.
Yeah.
Other people.
Right.
It's in other words, it's forcible. It's something that is not related to tradition. It's not related to the environment. Americans go out to be alone. That is, they're forcing their persona on everything else, including on their own selves. And you could say that this is what has become of the world. America has introduced that way of being a self everywhere, and as you were saying earlier in our conversation today, that necessarily dissolves all other cultures.
Right.
It's a kind of acid. And to get back to Peterson, the great contradiction in what he's trying to do is he's trying to produce very communitarian goals using precisely this acid. And it'll never work if he doesn't see how he has to let the acid, instead of using the acid, he has to let the acid dissolve himself, and then he would be able to reemerge in a way that it would enable a success of his communitarian goals.
Right. Now,